Because you can handle the truth.
Resurrect the Republic, Truth Radio Broadcast, on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Good morning, everybody. RTR Truth Media, Resurrect the Republic. This is Tom Lacoubera-Stewart here with you today. And we just, for those of you that know, we just got off of a long trip to Idaho and back. What a beautiful, beautiful countryside we got to see coming back. And we're still unloading and resetting up our studio here, which is going to be a blessing to us all. And, you know, when I was sitting back last night and I was thinking, you know, what I wanted to share with you guys today, just to let you know that in the near future, Adam Green and I, possibly this coming next week, are going to be doing a piece on Microsoft and Microsoft's involvement in Israel and how this technology, the Russia-China Israel alliance and the Belt and Road Initiative, how relevant that is as well. But today I want to share with you a historic piece from a man who I highly respect. His name is Paul Findlay. For those RBN listeners out there who have been listening for a long time, I'm sure that you know who I'm speaking of. Paul Findlay was a former United States representative from Illinois who represented his 20th district, a Republican, first elected in 1960, and he lost in 1982 to Dick Durbin. He's co-founder of the Council of National Interest, a Washington, D.C. advocacy group. He's 94 years old now. This man, and why I like to highlight people like this, is he had the courage and the audacity to speak the truth. And in the end, the real collusion that we're seeing with Israel, while everybody was screaming, Russia, 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 is just ironic to me how people do not see the massive control that Israel wields over American government. And Paul Findlay is a prime example of someone who was taken out. He 11 terms as a congressman, and his 12th term he was defeated because of the opposition that came from the likes of AIPAC. So this is a raw, unedited interview with Paul Findlay that took place some years ago, and I dare anyone to try and say that everything that the man has said in this interview is not absolutely relevant today. So, ladies and gentlemen, Paul Findlay.
I'm not going to ask you to introduce yourself because I'm going to have a narrator explain your background. So you don't have to explain what you were 22 years in the Congress and so forth. But some of the less notable people, you know, I asked them to give a little bio. But if you want to
interview Professor Frank or Wolf Fury, before you leave town, I better call him.
Well, the trouble is I've got...
You're already booked?
...down in Rolla, Missouri, scheduled later in the day.
Okay.
And that's, around supper time, and that might put us in a little bit of a bind, you know, because it takes, as you see, it takes a little while to get all this stuff hooked up. But I'm seeing that this trip to Illinois may not be our last. I think this is, there's every place we go, we find leads that, gee, too bad we didn't have time to, you know, spend a little more time with that person or the people that he's...
Well, you're good for another 40 years. You'll get around to it.
We are going to Kansas City, and we're going to be having a lot of time there, but we don't know anybody to contact.
The USS Liberty story.
Oh, yeah. Is there somebody there that's familiar with that?
I attended the Liberty Survivors Reunion in Nebraska about a month ago. Boy, they've got a story, and they sure welcome every chance to tell it.
Somebody in
and it's something the American people can understand.
Yeah. Doing our country, our servicemen dirty. I mean, that's, you know, that's about as low as...
There is no doubt from the historical record that Israel wanted to sink the ship and kill everybody aboard.
I don't think anybody knows about that.
That's part of the government policy to keep it unknown.
I've read your description in your first book.
Yeah.
I read.
There have been a lot of developments since then.
And recently, one of the prosecutors or the Navy.
Yeah, name
came out.
Captain Boston. He was the clerk, the sort of recorder of the so-called hearings that Admiral Kidd arranged. And he stated plainly that he and Kidd knew it was not the truth, and they were told by the higher-ups they had to lie, and they did. Isn't that sad that admirals have to lie?
Yeah. My opinion of Johnson dropped about 80%. You know, I know he did good stuff with Civil Rights Act, and I still admire him for that. But some of the
and he the, covered up the liberty cover up, thing because he wanted to keep the Jews in support of his policy. He didn't get them anyway. So it was wasted sacrifice on his part. He would have been remembered as a great president, except for that.
Yeah, he's got a dark side that puts him down. He's now down near the bottom of my list of post-war presidents. Eisenhower, I think Carter had a.
Carter tried occasionally.
His heart was in the right place.
I think. He didn't have quite enough backbone. But who does? Who does? I could have done more when I was in Congress. I was truly an innocent about the Middle East when I got elected.
How about telling the story of you know, the your constituent in the Yemen connection? That might be an interesting anecdote to kind of how you got into learning about all these issues.
Okay.
You're on.
I've often tried to think back and find just what it was that got me entangled in the Middle East. And more than anything else, it was a trip I made to what was called South Yemen, which was then a separate independent country on the Persian Gulf, or on the Arabian Gulf. I went there very reluctantly because I decided the only way I could ever see a constituent of mine would be to go there and rescue him somehow from imprisonment. He was a school teacher who had been tried for espionage, a trumped-up charge, totally without foundation, when he stopped on an unplanned time for airplane repairs in the capital of South Yemen. They thought he was a Britisher. They had thrown the British out a few years before. So they gave him a trial and sentenced him to 5 years of solitary confinement. And this is the jumping off place of the Arab world, South Yemen. Aden is the capital of the state at that time. And I went there to rescue him. And I was there almost a week before I had a chance to talk to the president of the country. He let me take my constituent home. It had a happy ending. But during that week, I got well acquainted with a young man, very fluent in English, who was my escort. We talked about religion because there wasn't much else to talk about in South Yemen, a very desolate place. And this opened my eyes as nothing else had, made me realize that there was an Arab side to the equation. Up to then, I'd been sympathetic pretty much with Israel because everybody else in Congress was. I had no real understanding of the Middle East situation when I was elected in 1961. Then I was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Committee in 67. And shortly after that, the challenge came to get this young man out of prison, so I jumped at the chance. And on the way down, I visited or went past the refugee camps that later became the center of a massacre by the Falangists supported by the Israelis. Then I took a side trip to Syria. The president of Syria, President Assad, had had no congressional visitors since the 67 war. So I was kind of a curiosity, and he gave me a couple hours for a conversation, and I learned still more about the Arab side of the equation. This, added to my experience in South Yemen, made me question the wisdom of U.S. policy, which was totally biased in favor of Israel and against Arab interests. And when I went back to Congress, I started raising questions, challenging whether our policy was right, demanding that Israel obey the terms of public law, which meant that they could not legally use U.S.-supplied weapons for anything except legitimate self-defense. Well, this made me a pariah. I became the number one target of Israel's very imposing and effective lobby. They pummeled me for 3 years in every way possible, and finally contributed very substantially to my defeat for a 12th term. But my defeat turned out to be a blessing. I have no regrets for trying to speak up for human rights of the Palestinians and to warn against the danger of our pro-Israel policy, not just for America and our interests, but for the sake of the Jews living in Israel. I think this living by the sword, trying to destroy the Palestinian people as a society, as a presence, is very harmful to Judaism, not to mention its harm in other respects to America. So that opened the door to the Middle East. That's why I got involved. I got entangled to such a deep extent that I lost my job on Capitol Hill, but it opened doors that never would have been opened to me otherwise. And I feel that my life has been much more fruitful and hopefully useful to the cause of justice. And if I had remained in Congress, where I would have been under constant pressure to fall in line, don't make waves, don't offer amendments, don't speak up for the Palestinians, just be guided by what Israel wants.
Okay, how about a little bit about the Liberty incident?
One of the few books I read while I was in Congress, I hate to admit it, but the life of a congressman is so challenged day and night, weekends and all, that very few find time to read books. But one book I read was a book called Assault on the Liberty, written by a man named James Ennis, who had been the deck officer when the USS Liberty, which was an intelligence-gathering ship off the coast of Egypt in June of 1967, came under assault by Israeli military forces. Now, we were already sympathetic to Israel as a government. Lyndon Johnson was president. He was secretly providing a lot of help to the Israeli cause. But nevertheless, for whatever reason, the government of Israel decided that our spy ship, our intelligence gathering ship, the USS Liberty, had to be destroyed. They were almost toward the end of their war with the Arab states. They had decided privately, secretly, that they were going to assault Syria the next day. And that's the only valid explanation I can come up with for the horrendous misdeeds they committed that day in June. They had broad daylight. They sent reconnaissance ships around the USS Liberty aircraft, around USS Liberty, over a period of several hours. And then they assaulted Liberty in bright daylight with the American flag streaming in a brisk breeze all the time. They used napalm, dropping it on the deck to burn some of the sailors alive. They used a torpedo ships to blast holes in the deck or in the side of the ship. One of them was over 40 feet wide. Somehow, the ship survived. It didn't sink. The Israeli fighter aircraft even shot to pieces life rafts that were put in the water when the captain, Captain McGonagall, thought, well, we're going to have to abandon ship. Well, they didn't have any life rafts to use for the abandonment, and they kept the ship afloat miraculously during the night. One of the radio operators was able to rig up a device to send an SOS out asking for help. They knew that the U.S. carrier aircraft were nearby. And the captain of one of the carriers launched some fighter aircraft in the air and headed them to the rescue of the USS Liberty when he received orders from the White House in Washington to get the aircraft back on the deck, which, of course, he had to do. From that day forward, despite the fact that 32 U.S. sailors were killed in broad daylight by a nation that had such a deep obligation to the American government, and over 150 were injured, despite all that, our government decided to clamp secrecy on it in every way possible. The survivors were told never to talk to a reporter about what had happened. Their testimony was not even requested when they had a so-called hearing, a hearing that the principals later on testified was full of lies, was a misrepresentation of what actually happened. Our government, for whatever reason, decided to try to keep the whole thing quiet. And they have succeeded to an alarming extent to this very day. It ranks as one of the worst peacetime disasters the U.S. Navy ever had, and yet nobody in Congress has been willing to call hearings to lay the facts before the American people. It's one of the saddest chapters in our relationship with Israel. Fortunately, the crewmen are never say die type. They have an organization. They do all they can to keep the episode alive, to make more people, American people, aware of it. And I believe the time will come before all of them die off when they will have a proper hearing. They have certainly done all they could to bring it to public light. And if the American people knew what happened that day, I believe there would be a fundamental quick change in U.S. policy toward the state of Israel. Not to shut the door to Israel, but to put our relationship on a balanced basis instead of the total bias in favor of Israel that prevails today.
I think I've read other reports of that incident. I saw a video, one of these TV-sponsored videos, Discovery Channel type of thing. And also, one of the books I read that kind of was the inside view of Israeli actions was that Moshe Dayan was the person that gave the go-ahead on that. I don't know if that is something you've heard, but that's...
Well, there's a lot of argument over whether it was mistaken identity on the part of Israel. That theory has been shot to pieces, but it keeps bubbling up year after year nevertheless, because Israel has a big stake here.
Yeah.
They know that if the truth were known about the USS Liberty in June 67, the American people would be up in arms.
The one of the authors that I've been reading, he's an Israeli, and his latest book, and I can't remember the author's name now, but I was looking through his latest book at the library, at the bookstore, and in that, he states that he has a copy of the air traffic tapes that between the fighter pilots and their command base, in which one of the pilots said, you know, basically, hey, this is an American ship. You know, and being told, well, keep on shooting. You know, basically, that's like a smoking gun.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't, he referred to that he had a copy, but he didn't put that in his book. And maybe it was even too hot for him to...
Well, fortunately, over the years, a lot of background documentation has come to light. And it proves without a doubt that the fighter aircraft, under orders to assault the ship, were informed headquarters that it was an American ship, and one of them said, this is murder. This is murder of American sailors. So it was known. Maybe they thought beating Syria to the Golan Heights was worth the loss of American lives. But to me, it was a colossal disgrace to the state of Israel to have that on their record. And I don't think they can ever do anything to make full amends for it. They've got a lot to answer for over the years, and that's one of them.
How about... maybe describing some of the people in your first book, the ones that spoke out. Pick one or two examples of how they tried to speak out and were beaten down or sabotaged by various pressure groups. I know that you had 10 or 15 examples, but maybe pick one or two that... or particularly flagrant or notable?
Adlai Stevenson III was a U.S. senator. Before that, he was a state elected official statewide, a man of great prestige, partly because of his name, partly because of his own service. When he ran for governor, the lobby for Israel remembered that when he was a senator, he supported an amendment to cut aid to Israel. Now, he supported aid to Israel, as I did, on other issues. But the fact that he had once supported openly a cut in aid to Israel made them nervous. They thought he... as a candidate for governor after serving the Senate, his next step would be the White House. They didn't want anybody with that attitude towards aid to Israel ever to occupy the White House. And he was defeated, and when I interviewed Adlai after Election Day, he said that there is no doubt in his mind but what the opposition of the supporters of Israel to his candidacy were a major factor. Charles Percy, the boy wonder in industry, became a U.S. senator. I became quite close to him, so I knew very well what went on. He was concerned about our bias towards Israel, but he did very little in the public realm about it. He once criticized Menachem Begin, the Israeli prime minister, for some outrageous deed that the prime minister had committed. But he always supported aid to Israel. In fact, as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, he even secured support and adoption of amendments to increase aid to Israel beyond what the U.S. administration had asked for. But because he supported the sale of certain intelligence-type aircraft, AWACS aircraft, for Saudi Arabia, as a senator, he voted for that and helped to get the approval through the Senate, one of the few times that the lobby for Israel failed to win what it wanted. Because of that, he was singled out for defeat. He was defeated by Paul Simon, another good friend of mine, a Democrat. And when I interviewed Paul Simon for my book, I asked him about how he decided to run against Percy. And he said that one of the main factors that led to his decision was the promise from the Jewish community of North Chicago area that he would have $500,000 up front for his campaign if he decided to seek that particular campaign. And he said that he wasn't sure whether he would have decided to run in the absence of that offer. He also said something very significant that I've often cited. He said, you know, money and politics are mixed together. In so many words, he said, we might as well open our eyes and face the facts that when we're at the end of a busy day and we come back to our desk and we see a spindle with a whole bunch of callback notes on it, people that want you to call back, you thumb through the notes and you spot the ones that have given you $1,000 in the campaign. And naturally, it's human nature to call them first. And the others, if you have time, but call them first. He said that's reality. You have to recognize reality. He's right. I had the same experience. It shows the impact of money in politics and why the dollars supplied by various political action committees devoted to Israel are so important to the cause of that lobby. When I ran against Dick Durbin, I guess it was, in 1982, he was a good candidate. He worked hard. But he benefited from all of the anti-Semitic charges that had been made against me because of my concern about our bias in favor of the State of Israel. And Durbin received, I believe, $130,000 from various pro-Israel political action committees. By today's standards, that's not an overwhelming sum. But back in 1982, that was big money. In fact, I had to raise about $1 million each of the last two campaigns to carry on my campaign. And 90% of the money that went to my opponents in behalf of my defeat came from Jewish sources. Now, that's not my estimate. That's the estimate of the lobby for the State of Israel when they bragged about how well they defeated me and how they did it. They stated that that about 90% of the money came from their efforts, which shows that a determined group of people, even a small group of people, who will use the opportunities that our political system offers to everyone, if they will use those opportunities effectively, they can really do wonders. And when I talk to Arab American groups or Muslim groups, I cite that the doors to success in the American political system are wide open to anyone if you'll really put your heart into it as the supporters of Israel do, if you'll dig deep in your pockets as they do, if you'll stay with it and support your friends, defeat your enemies, you can get a lot done. They're in the infancy of American politics, and they've made some progress, but not enough to overcome what is exists today. I might add, too, it's a mistake to say that the Jews are the source of trouble, period. The political power of Israel derives even more from Christians than from Jews. In fact, I believe that the percentage of pro-Israel Christians who are truly zealots for Israel is far greater than the percentage of pro-Israel Jews. A lot of people that call themselves Jews hardly ever go to the synagogue. They really don't follow their faith. They're supporters of Israel, but that's about it. Among Christians, there are probably 75 or 80 million people, million Americans, who believe that a strong Israel is an important part of God's plan. And they believe it. There's no way to argue with them about it. They really believe that's part of God's plan. When I was campaigning one year in a country part of my district, a young man who had been elected as a Republican county clerk, I think, came to me after my talk about Middle East affairs, and with a worried look on his face, he said, I want you to know that you're speaking against the will of God. You don't understand what God wants our country to do. And I urge you to change your view for your own sake in getting reelected, but for the larger cause of God's will. And that man was very serious. He wasn't trying to browbeat me in any way. He was trying to be nice to me. Thought he was being helpful. Well, that absolute conviction about God's will in the Middle East is an immense problem. Most Christians don't follow that line of thought, but unfortunately, a lot of them do. I would say the number who do is growing rapidly.
Growing, not just large.
Yeah. A lot of people are very anxious, with good reason, about the future, their own future, what's going to happen when they die, and they seize on certainty, and they can find certainty in what are often preached to them by the evangelists on television.
Are there any particular evangelists that, you know, are in the forefront of that movement?
Well, Pat Robertson, of course, is very prominent, Jerry Falwell. And they have a following, tremendous following. Pat Robertson showed it when he ran for president a while back. And they have a tremendous influence in the administration of George W. Bush. Without their support, he never would have made it. And I might add that without the support of U.S. Muslims, he never would have made it either. Which means that the basis for his election was religious. Support of Christians, support of Jews, support of Muslims. Now, the way he's behaved, he lost a lot of that support. Muslims won't support him again, I'm quite sure. Muslims are a growing part of our society. And I feel so sorry about them these days because they are so often on the defensive. Most of the people who pulled off 9/11 were Saudis, they were Muslims. Most of the Iraqis are Muslims, including those who are the insurgents and causing such trouble these days. They violate the teachings of the Quran. The Quran teaches against suicide. It preaches against the killing of innocent people. And so when those impassioned people, motivated by whatever it is that makes them do these dreadful things, act as they do, carry out suicide bombings in Israel and elsewhere, dreadful, inhuman acts, they are not following the teachings of their faith. I don't approve of what they do, but I think I understand how young people especially, who have known nothing but the oppression that the Palestinians have had to live under year after year after year, become so depressed and fanatic that they commit these terrible crimes.
Yesterday, or the day before, we did an interview with a member of IAP up in Chicago.
Who was it? Farik?
Yeah,
I know him. Sure, he's a great guy.
Yeah. And he was sadly telling us that that organization is being sued in civil court by relatives of a Jewish American that was killed in one of the suicide attacks in Israel, to the tune of $600 million, with the IAP being called a front organization for whatever, like, I guess front for Hamas or whoever was actually the culprits in that. And they're trying to figure out how they're even going to mount a defense.
Well, the political atmosphere today in America is dreadful. Anyone with the name Muhammad or Ahmed is automatically on the defensive. Talk to a man who, with his very young son, who lived in Canada, was coming down the East Coast, crossing the border, to attend a Muslim convention about 2 years ago. He said the border guard, a U.S. official, stopped him, wanted to see his passport before he let him come in. He noted that his first name was Muhammad. That's all he needed to know. He said, pull over here. It was a boiling hot day. And he had to sit there in the heat with his young son for over 2 hours before he was permitted to proceed, just because of his name. And I'm afraid incidents like that have occurred time and time again. Hundreds have been rounded up for detention, held indefinitely without any charge being made against them, any charge to answer. And those indignities are going to live on for a long time, in the memory of the young people especially. I've found Muslims to be wonderful people. I'd love to have them as next door neighbors. Without exception, the ones I've dealt with have been fine. And they're proud to be American citizens. But they're being harassed now in a brutal way. I hope they survive in good spirit and optimism about America. But these are tough tests for them. And one thing that really troubles me is the lack of awareness of the American people for their own responsibility for the terrible misdeeds being done to the Palestinians these days. They don't realize that they're complicit in everything that Israel does. Israel could never have pulled off this brutality over a 30-year period without the uncritical, unconditional support of the U.S. government. Christian Science Monitor published a report on the cost to the American people of aid to Israel just a couple of months ago. It's a respected newspaper. I think all will accept that. The surveyor came to the conclusion that the cost of the aid to Israel, including the outlays and the cost of the federal debt, since 1975, has topped $1.3 trillion. Not billion, but trillion dollars. Now, dollars are only a part of the price we've paid. We've paid such a horrendous price in loss of goodwill throughout the world. There was a day when Eisenhower was president. I remember that day vividly and with great satisfaction, when America was revered, beloved throughout the Arab Muslim world, throughout the whole world, in fact, because we stood up for justice for the Arab side when Israel was trying to take control of the Suez Canal and topple the Gamal Nasser, who was then the president of Egypt. That was a happy day. We were heroes because we stood up for the human rights and the sovereignty of small Arab states. Now that's gone. I hope we can someday recover it, but the price we're paying for our blind bias, total bias, in favor of Israel, year after year, without any sympathy or regard for the rights of Palestinians, is enormous. Big in dollars, big in every other way.
That point in Eisenhower's career may represent the high moral high point of this country.
Well, Stephen Ambrose, the great biographer, who was certainly the greatest biographer of Eisenhower, said that that was the high point of American prestige worldwide. To make his point stick, Ike had to take on not just Israel, but France and Great Britain. Israel had persuaded those two countries to join them in a military assault on Egypt, and they could easily have prevailed. They could have won control of the Suez Canal, which was their main objective. And, of course, that was a part of the territory of the sovereign state of Egypt. And all of them were members of the UN. And the UN Charter prohibits the acquisition of territory by force of arms. And Ike stood up for the UN. He went to the UN, and through the UN, he was able to bring about a ceasefire and eventual withdrawal from all of the disputed territory. That was a great moment for America. And now we're on the other side. We have been parties. We've been complicit in the acquisition of Arab territory little by little over the years by the state of Israel. It's as if we've been their partners in war, because that has been the effect.
You don't hear too much about Ike anymore as a hero.
No.
Not, like, you know, he's not revered like Reagan and all that. Doesn't have that aura of godliness, you know.
Well, that, I'm afraid, is true. It's sad how soon we forget events that are great and important. I'm 83 years old. I've had so many opportunities that I don't deserve, but I relished. One of them was a chance to talk to Ike privately a number of times. He was president for about 2 weeks after I got elected in January of 61. His term was over the 20th of that month. And after he went to Gettysburg, I organized a group of congressmen in the House who were interested in NATO, the North Atlantic Alliance. And because of that, he welcomed me into his office. We had quite a few chats. And he said something that ought to be engraved on every legislative chamber. One day, reflecting on his own years in the White House and missed opportunities that he should have seized, he said, "We tend to deal with urgent problems and leave the important ones until tomorrow." A lot of wisdom in that one statement. It'd be a good thing for all of us to remember. We deal with the urgent problems, leave the important ones until tomorrow. and we've left the important ones until tomorrow in the Middle East. The important ones were that we should have stood firmly for justice above everything else, justice. And we didn't. We haven't. It's not too late, but I don't see at the moment any presidential timber that is going to change things. I hate to say that.
Both parties kind of want and paid for it. It's sort of Professor Boyle's assessment of the two principal parties. They're bought and paid for.
Yeah.
And it's got to come from the grassroots, like the initiatives he takes. You know, grassroots, waking people up at the grassroots.
That's right. That's right.
The only path that's really got a chance.
And that takes a lot of vision and commitment. I have to take my hat off to the lobbyists for Israel. They are committed people. They never seem to sleep. They know what buttons to push. And for the most part, they operate within the law. They have literally taken over our political system as far as the Middle East is concerned. They recognize the important parts of our society that help to contribute to policy decisions. First one, of course, is Capitol Hill. That can properly be called Israeli-occupied territory, as it often is. That we deserve to have that label on Capitol Hill. But it's also true of the executive branch. They have infiltrated every office that has any importance whatever in the formulation or execution of policy that touches the Middle East. They are there. They have people that have this deep allegiance to the State of Israel who will respond to anything that's in any way puts Israel in a bad way. Now, it goes beyond that, though. They have an organization throughout the country of very skilled, impressive individuals that can be tapped on a short notice to come to the defense of Israel, no matter what Israel does. And nobody else, I shouldn't say nobody else is on the other side, but people working the U.S. national interest are not nearly as numerous and as effective as those for the State of Israel.
Can you describe some of the more recent work you've done and your writings?
Well, I've written three major books since I left Congress on the Middle East. One was They Dare Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby. Various editions of that have sold over 300,000 books. That's a lot of them. I hope all of them have been read. They've been sold, at least. I also wrote a book called Deliberate Deceptions that came out on the eve of the celebrated handshake between Rabin and Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn. And that event created the unjustified thought that peace is at hand, that everything's going to fall in place, and of course it didn't, it hasn't. It has not been a big seller, but it continues to sell. It's a reference book about the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And then I spent about 2.5 years writing a book called Silent No More, Confronting America's False Images of Islam, because Muslims are a very prominent part of American society. The book was published a couple of months before 9/11, but that event made it all the more important for the American people to understand what Muslims are all about, why they like to be in America, what they're up to, what they do. And there's a lot of misinformation about Muslims that has intensified since 9/11, because most Americans have never met a Muslim in their life. I was 51 before I ever met a Muslim knowingly. I probably had met several before, but I didn't know it. And I was in the dark about what Islam was all about. I had images from childhood attending Presbyterian Sunday school that weren't very flattering to Muhammad, to the Quran, and all that. And these were not removed until I became personally acquainted with Islam in South Yemen, as I mentioned, and in meeting with Muslims elsewhere. They're a wonderful part of America. They're contributing substantially in all of the major professions. They need to get into government and politics and journalism more than they have. And one of them received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, a scientist at the University of California. So they're high quality people that we should rejoice in having them among us. They number about maybe 7 million, and they're fast growing. They tend to have large families. They're great family-oriented people. They're believers. They believe in the God that Christians and Jews worship. They just go about it a little different way.
I know I heard Pat Robertson saying that, now those Muslims, they don't, you know, they've got a different God. He's called Allah.
That's right.
We don't have, you know, that's nothing to do with our God. And they don't know that. Very literally, they consider themselves to be worshipped into the same God.
They consider Abraham their spiritual ancestor, just as Christians and Jews do. Allah is simply the Arabic word for God. The Bible is printed in Arabic, and where God is mentioned in the Bible, in the New Testament and elsewhere, they use the word Allah, because it's the Arabic word.
You know, Christian Palestinians use the same word when they talk about
that's right.
You know,
but you know, in the wake of 9/11, that horrific event, it has colored the attitude of the American people in a way that's going to be very difficult to change, because they know that the ones who did it were avowed Muslims. They didn't act as Muslims when they did those things. But really, surveys show that most Americans think that Muslims condone violence and terrorism, and they don't. It's a false image. So I've been doing what I could in my own little way to try to dispel those images.
Do you speak? Do you have a speaking schedule?
I often speak to Muslim groups, and I welcome other opportunities. I speak on campus whenever I get an invitation. I think that's the best thing I can do. As a Christian, I can relate my experiences with Muslims, and I hope it's helpful to the cause of understanding. I don't try to sell anybody on becoming a Muslim. That's not my goal. My goal is simply to get the truth about their faith across to Christians. I urge Muslims to go to church services, to Christian churches, and after church shake hands with the leadership and offer to come and answer questions at a Bible class. And a lot of them are doing that, and that helps. I urge Christian leaders to invite Muslims to come to the church for a discussion. And some have been doing that, but a lot more is needed.
Can do you mind reading that letter from the good?
Well, my book Silent No More has been sent to a number of church leaders, Methodist, Presbyterian, and recently copies went to Evangelical Lutherans. Now, this is one branch of the Lutheran Church that is considered more liberal than the Missouri Synod. They mix in the community much more. They seem to have a little broader interest in community affairs. So this branch was selected for distribution of the book because the sponsors felt that the book would be read and used in the churches. Well, I received one letter from a minister in New York City, pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of the Covenant. And he really unloaded, to my amazement. He said that, thank God you are no longer a U.S. congressman representing this country. And that's coming from a Democrat who did not vote for Bush. Let me offer one quote for your publicity about your book. Although we know, both know you won't print it on the book cover, quote, misguided, bordering on treason. Mr. Finley, these are not false stereotypes. I call them false images of Islam that need to be dismissed. He said, we need to extricate all Muslims from this country. We need to extricate, that's his word, extricate, all Muslims from this country, all these Arab cells, and never allow them again to enter this hallowed land. That from a man who obviously graduated from seminary someplace. It really boggles the mind that anyone could achieve the ministry of a major denomination and harbor such awful ideas. The idea of driving out all Muslims from America and keeping them out. It's an echo of what the late Rabbi Meir Kahane, a very radical leader of Israel, recommended. He said, let's drive the Arabs out. He wrote a book, the title was The Arabs Must Go. And I'm sure he believed it. That's only a few steps from what Hitler was talking about the Jews in Europe. It makes me realize the depth of the problem that the American people face. When a clergyman would jump to such a radical, outrageous conclusion as to drive all the Muslims out of the country, we've got a big job ahead in this country to save America itself. I'm 83. I hope I live long enough to see if those images dismiss.
I hope so. Let's see. I think I got a good representative impression of your thoughts and your experiences.
Well, one thing I'd like to add, I believe in religion. I believe in God. I'm not really intensely devoted to a particular framework of religion. Abraham Lincoln never joined a church. Maybe I feel this way because of my fondness for Lincoln.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. Center. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2 keep it today.
This is RBN.